So we are here backstage at the Fantastic Cream Man Festival. I'm chatting to you, Stuart Lee.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, I can't believe you've agreed to do it. I assume you thought it was something else.
No, I'm happy to talk to you.
Okay. Yeah. Well, also, and I have the utmost respect for Green Man and you, but I sort of don't understand why you're here.
Well, I don't really like doing comedy at festivals because there tends to be a lot of noise spill, like this now. My stand-up, an editor pointed out to me when they were editing it that it goes to a metronomic rhythmical.
Wow.
And even when I come off the beat or whatever, I get back to it. So I'll be 20 minutes into half-hour set, last 10 minutes, you know, somebody goes on the main stage, a long way away, but the noise bleed will knock me completely out. And it's like flying blind. You know, I can't hear the audience. I can't hear myself. So, but I started doing them again because my kids started wanting to go. So I thought, is there a half an hour that I can get through on autopilot of 40-year-old material that I used to do in tryout spots? And there just about is. But here, it's programmed by Henry Widdicombe, who knows what he's doing. He puts together bills that feel like shows, where the comics fit together into a bill, rather than it being somewhere you go if you're depressed or wet. So people go to watch the acts. And also there's kind of seating in there, which really changes how people feel they're in a theatre, I think.
Yeah.
But there seems to be something about this setup here that's quite good.
Can I say what it is?
Yeah,
it's Wales, and Wales is magic.
Is it? Because Wales is magic, it's acoustically secure.
I'm so interested in your different evolutions. How do you keep pushing yourself, and challenging your audience?
Well, I'm very lucky with the audience, right? And I don't quite know how it's happened, but the people that come trust me and often allow me a little bit of leeway. And if something doesn't look like it's going anywhere, which it often doesn't, they trust that it eventually will, and it normally does. So I'm really lucky with the audience, right? And they're a much wider spread of people than, you know, the right-wing press will go, they're all Guardian readers from North London. There aren't a quarter of a million Guardian readers in total in the world, and that's about the amount that come on tour. So I don't know what. Anyway, then in terms of changing the shows, for about the last 10-15 years, each show, I tried to do something in it, which is something I would never have wanted to do and don't think that I can. This current one, for example, there's a lot of physical comedy in it, which is not something I ever wanted to do or really liked. And then I sort of forced myself to do a kind of Max Wall style routine involving a stool and falling off it. And I'm not an actor, but the second half I'm basically in a costume and in character, and I had to learn to do an accent that's convincing and to move around in a really heavy costume, and to basically treat my body as a kind of puppet, which is been a sharp learning curve. So it's always try to do something different. And it also amuses me because people say that I do the same thing over and over again, and I absolutely, you know, I just really don't do that.
And also that's wild, because something else I was thinking about with you is you've worked in so many mediums. You started with stand-up, did double act, you've written musicals, you've written books, you write articles, you do your own stand-up shows. There's lots of mediums you're working in. I wouldn't say any of it is similar, but there is a really strong thread going through. Your fingerprints are all over it.
Yeah, well, that's nice. I mean, you are who you are, aren't you? But I suppose, to be honest, I don't really want to work in other mediums. You know, stand-up, I've been doing it 36 years now, so I'm interested in what happens if you carry on. Mm. You know, what happens if you carry on and try to change it every time, and who will come and see you when you're 70, and all those sorts of things are of interest to me.
I know we've seen that with like George Carlin and things like that, but in this UK British alternative scene, I'm interested in that as well, because we haven't seen that. You're at like the front.
You're interested in me doing it?
Well, kind of generation. Yeah. We haven't seen, like, is it like pop stars where you fade away and then everyone loves you again for your farewell tour? You know, what is
the journey? Well, what I think it's like now is I think it's a bit like when I would take my kids to see some old dying jazz bloke or something, and I took him to see the Sun Ra Orchestra, you know, and the main guy's 100 now.
Wow.
And I just thought you should see this, because although there's loads of great, particularly British, like free jazz musicians now, young ones, it is a kind of a thing that had a particular time and was produced by a particular set of cultural circumstances. And I think people bring their kids to see me. It's like, come on, this is what an alternative comedian was like from the, you know, so, and then they quite like it and come back.
But I'm so interested in you in how you do keep Because there's always a response to what's going on in your work. For instance, I'm thinking of social media. Now, there is no one I know who would start doing comedy now, you know, whatever age, whatever background, who would think that you could not buy into that, that you wouldn't have to be on TikTok, on Instagram, etc., making content. And you always have a response to what is going on, but you don't necessarily do it.
I've got no social media presence whatsoever. I haven't got a YouTube channel. I haven't got a Facebook. I haven't got Instagram. I haven't got anything.
But you're all over. You're all over them.
Put it out. In fact, my agent said to me the other day, we need to get you a YouTube channel.
Yeah.
And you need to put your content on it because other people are making money out of it, which I wasn't really aware you could do.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I will do that. And then she also said, you could film your own specials and put them straight onto YouTube, and there's some way of paying for that apparently. But no, one of the problems in not being on social media is that if a publisher wants to know if you're worth investing in, they look at how many followers you've got, and I've got no followers, right? And if I say to them, yeah, but I can get 200,000 people on tour, it just doesn't compute. They don't really know what that means. So that creates problems in getting work paid for. But it also saves me a lot of problems. Like I wouldn't be cancelled for the reasons that people that do Comedy Unleashed say they're cancelled. But there have been bad faith efforts by people on the right to willfully misunderstand things that I've said to lose me work, right? The more social media presence I have, the more at risk I am of that. I am the sort of person that would be likely to go on social media drunk at 2:30 in the morning and engage in unrestrained comment.
Something else I pick up on from when we chat, when I watch your work, that's very unusual about you, especially for the level and you're at, is you are kind of brutally honest when it comes to nuts and bolts, numbers of things. So you'll mention how many people came to see you on tour. The show I was watching, basically, you literally mentioned how much you get paid to do this special.
Yeah.
Whereas all that is normally deliberately kept quite shy.
Yeah.
And then you talk about, and this is how much I'll get after it. And you do the maths on stage.
Yeah, because I don't make enough to be embarrassed about it. if I was getting paid, well, actually, then there's a weird thing with the other end. Ricky Gervais wants you to know that he got 60 million.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
So
yeah.
It's the people in the middle ground you have to watch, isn't it? Yeah. So.
And also, you know, in the past, you've talked about the more clandestine stuff that goes on in comedy. It's quite normal for people to have writers and not credit them, things like that. It feels like transparency is very important to you. It's part of your raison d'être.
Yeah. I think it's funny as well, though. I mean, I think it's funny. I mean, the character of Stuart Lee on stage would say those things, which is why he says them, because he doesn't understand those kind of boundaries.
Right.
I don't want to go into all this really, because there are people that deserve it more than me. But in lockdown, some stuff happened, and the GP did a spot test and went, "Well, you're neurodiverse, and you could get a proper diagnosis, but you've scored like 27 out of 30. You know, it's pretty good." And then I kind of realised when I read about the condition and lots of things.
I'm going to be explicit, just because not everyone listening will know.
Well,
so, but
a form of Asperger's, I suppose.
Yeah.
Lots of the things that I think are funny are, like a failure to. Like, someone will do something and you think, well, why would you do that? It's illogical. That's the way we think, and then that seems funny to you, as does, and things that I find profoundly irritating, are just not to other people. So it's kind of, you sort
it's
of realise...
It's perfect comedy angle, right?
It is perfect comedy, yeah. And I realise how many things, traced my real father, and he had hearing aids, and he said, well, you're probably deaf, everyone is. And my ex, Bridget Christie, she went, well, of course you're deaf, And then I went for a test, and they went, why haven't you got hearing aids? And I realised that a lot of my stand-up, up to that point, it had increasingly been about me being frustrated by audiences not responding enough. So I developed this sort of character, going, what's wrong with you? This is really good. And it was sort of a joke, but it was also like, I would be annoyed with them. And also, there always seemed to be... For some reason, it never struck me as odd, but the quietest people always seem to be on the far back left. And then that's where the...
It's your worst hearing.
It's the worst bit of hearing. What an idiot. Right? But actually, the problem created this sort of character. So what then happened was, when I first got hearing aids, and I remember I was doing a month of new material in the stand, in I could hear like drills on the other side of the road in people's houses and stuff. And it was, and I thought, oh my God, like, we're so lucky that, like, in our job, things that would be an inconvenience to other people, you can kind of find them and make them into your clown, you know. Yeah. And so really, it's a real, I mean, I don't know what ordinary people do. How do they cope?
Your audience, I'm interested in how it's evolved, because one thing, I think you have a really beautiful dialogue with your audience, in that you very kind of, you know them, you're very self-aware, so you know, and it's part of sort of the, like, the meta narrative, you know the kind of person who comes to see you. You rib them in a very warm way, yeah. and then also you sort of make fun of yourself in a very warm way. But it's still laser sharp. It's not cuddly.
Okay, my audience like to be attacked for being virtue signaling Guardian readers and who like jazz and read and stuff. And you can't be rude enough to them. They really, really laugh at it. Which is the difference, I think, between an audience that you might get for what we might now call the far right comedians, which are starting to exist in this country. Mm. That audience wouldn't like to be attacked.
Yeah.
You know, and similarly, they want other people to be attacked, but
yeah,
not them. Yeah, but so they like it, and it gives them a sense of having been noticed, I think, and they enjoy it. But it also gives us all in the room collectively leeway to go further into what we are interested in, because we've acknowledged that we're on some level some kind of a stereotype. But they're also great because most nights, without realizing it or without pre-planning it, they become the other half of a double act, right? Where they, I don't have to finish off certain sentences. They anticipate them. They kind of, also 9 times out of 10, when I do audience interaction, which I try to do, I try to do audience interaction now increasingly, but to make it about quite odd subjects or ethical issues rather than where you're from, you know, whatever. And they tend to sort of give me things that they think I can work with. They kind of seem to understand that it's not about blocking you or trying to be the funniest person.
See what you can do with this.
Yeah, they can't. Yeah, it's really interesting. I sometimes they don't, and we obviously all need to be match fit to deal with audience. But there's more than one way of doing it. You don't necessarily have to fight them. You can do what I do, which is to treat their heckles as genuine inquiries and try to muddle. So, you know, I think if I do get problems with audiences, it's some where I'm trying to get an answer out of them, and they're worried that they're going to be on the sharp end of a humiliation, and I wouldn't deliberately do that to someone. Mm. You know, I try to actually reverse engineer the conversation so that they get the laugh, and which of course what I spent the years in the double act doing. But it's sort of you know, you kind of want them to have fun, and now there's this assumption that they're going to be bullied, which is why I think it's perfectly reasonable. I mean, those that Russian guy and that bloke, they went on Joe Rogan and said that it was ridiculous that the comedy clubs in Britain, you could wear a badge saying "Don't pick on me." And there was one in London. And if neurodiverse people want to go out, it's sometimes terrifying for them to think they're going to be spoken to or picked on. And so, is it the end of the world for there to be one club on planet Earth where someone can wear a thing saying "Please don't pick on me"?
No one is forcing you to go to that comedy club,
right? So I think, you know, it is worth remembering that. And also, if there's someone in the front row and I just need an answer for something, and they go, "Oh, don't talk to me," I go, "Fine," and they go on to the next person. I can't be bothered with it. You know, I don't think I'd really like it, to be honest. I'm not the sort of person that would like it. So, yeah.
My sketch group do loads of audience interaction, and loads of it. But two of them have chronic anxiety.
Right, well, that's perfect.
It's perfect because they can recognise it and they pick up on all those micro signals and they never ask anything they would hate to be asked.
Yeah.
And they just, you just have ways of it where the people who are happy to engage come forward. You're listening to Kiri's Comedy Club. It's an Icons episode with the magnificent Stuart Lee. I'm your host, Kiri Pritchard-McLean. This episode was recorded backstage at the festival Green Man. It was a really fantastic chat, and we got into so many fascinating subjects, including trying to explain who he is to taxi drivers, which is absolute gold. Let's get back to him. I wanted to talk about, if you're comfortable to, the some misconceptions I've sort of clocked about you. Number one is I was very intimidated when we first met because of, not just because you're so like, obviously very bright from everything I've seen, you know, very intelligent, but and very capable. So there's like, and but also there's a hierarchy, right, in comedy. So you're like, you know, there is.
Yeah, I mean, but I know what you're trying to say, but I sort of am. And I mean, for example, this is a conversation if I get in a cab. Where have you been tonight? Leicester Square Theatre. Oh, yeah, did you go and see a show? No, I was working. What were you doing? I'm a stand-up comedian. Oh, yeah, were you on a bill there with other people? No, I was doing my own show. Your own show? What, just one night? No, I'm there for 6 months. What, 6 months once a week? No, 6 months, five nights a week. What's your name? Stuart Lee. I've not heard of you. Oh, 6 months, yeah. So where do you play normally? Blah, blah, blah. What is that? The Royal Festival Hall, yeah. I've not heard of you, mate. No, I know, yeah. Do you know so-and-so? Yeah. And then they ask me about all these other people, and I always say how great they are. And I try to give them like a bit of an anecdote they can use that doesn't incriminate anyone but is nice. Like, oh, I saw John Bishop there play to 20 people. Isn't he brilliant at making a room feel intimate? Yes, you know, whatever. As we drive past the Essex Road pub where, you know, and then at the end, the bloke goes, I'll tell you who I really like, Andrew Lawrence. And then I get out of the cab. And that's that, they've heard of him, right? So honestly, that when I first met my sisters 10 years ago, they'd never heard of me, you know, and then they were really, they always ring me up. To this day, they go, oh, I met a woman at work and her husband really likes you. He goes to see you. I go, yeah. I mean, you've seen, I've got a house and stuff. I mean, I'm obviously like making a living. You know, so it is on the one hand, yeah, like people go, oh, I can't believe I've met you. And, but on the other hand, It's I'm also invisible as well.
That's very interesting, because that feels unique to you.
Well, I'm very pleased about it, really.
But when I met you, I was like, okay, I was a bit sort of nervous.
Yeah.
I was really surprised at how warm you were, at how interested you are in new comics.
Well, I don't see as much as I do because I'm not on circuit bills anymore. And also, I am aware, probably because of what you say, if I go to a 40-seater room in Edinburgh to see a new act, me being in it changes the room and makes the gig worse for that person. Mm. And in fact, Daniel Kitson, who you won't have heard of, but who we all think is the best comedian in the world, said to me it was irresponsible of me to go and see people. It wasn't fair because I said, oh, you know that person you said were really good? I went to see them and they seemed really nervous and the audience were quiet. And he went, well, you were in the room, weren't you? How many other people were there? Six. And he went, well, you ruined it by being there. And I thought, oh, yeah, I see. I probably did, actually. You know.
Something else about you as well, because I think people lazily use you as some great sort of totemic symbol of, like, North London metropolitan liberal elite. Yeah, yeah. When one thing's that surprised me about you and is important to me as a foster carer is that you're a care experienced person, which is one of the, we now recognise is one of the most default marginalised that you can be as a person, but no one would clock that view, and maybe that's your own choosing.
Well, if you'd asked me about this a year ago, I wouldn't have really had an answer for it, but I don't know how this happened, but the NHS put me on some sort of therapy course for people that were adopted or in care in the 50s, 60s, 70s, because they feel there are very specific problems that created. And I was very suspicious of it. Mm. And then in the first week, they go, do you do this, this, and this, this? And I go, yeah. And they go, well, the highest amount of people that do that are people that were adopted again. And it's all these things that I wouldn't have believed it until it's there in black and white as a statistical truth that it creates all these very specific problems. But they're also problems that, you know, they give you a feeling of disconnection from society. They give you a rootlessness. They give you a predisposition towards a negative view of the world and of people. And all of that is great.
Perfect for standard comedic.
I know. You know, all these things that we've all got. And you think, well, if you unraveled it What would be left?
My friend Michael J. Dolan, great comic, yeah. He always said the best comedians have a unique worldview, and it's always on the outside looking in, and everything that you're describing, so many care experienced young people, I feel like when I speak to them, and neurodiverse people as well, feel like there's a pane of glass between them and the rest of the world.
Yeah.
Comedy's you trying to get through the glass,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, look at it and be... Well, look, McIntyre's mandraw routine is an absolute apogee of someone noticing something that everyone does but hasn't given a name to,
yeah.
Right? And that's one kind of comedy. But another kind is to look through this pane of glass that you've so brilliantly described there at something that everyone seems to think is normal, and then you go, that's insane and wrong, and why are you all doing it?
You are so self-aware on stage of yourself, your audience, their perception of themselves, your perception of them, your perception of yourself. I sometimes think in comedy, self-awareness can be a curse when it comes to making stuff, because you put these kind of intellectual, you can put so many intellectual hurdles in front of yourself. And I don't know if you've ever had it where you're writing a show and you're almost thinking, well, if I was a reviewer, I'd pull them up over that. So you end up putting a joke to sort of quell that. And you're like, that's not the funniest joke, but it's doing that job. Like, do you ever get knotted in that?
I agree with you. It can be a problem working in the dark on paper, right? And you do tend to self-censor and you lose your nerve with certain things. That's why I think ultimately we're not, what our art form, it's not a written form, right? So you can write it, but it has to sound like you've just thought of it.
Mm.
You can put in the odd bit that sounds structured, but it has to sound like it's going to you in real time. And it also has to respond to the room more than any other art form. No other art form needs to be genuinely or create the illusion of being a dialogue in the way that we do. So I think before you lose your nerve on something on paper and self-censor it or worry that it's, you have to do it, you have to try it in a room. It might be that you have to try it a lot. And there's a quote from John Cage about this, the avant-garde composer. You know, he says something like, if something seems boring at 3 minutes, try it for six. If it seems boring at six, try it for 12. It's 12, 24. If at 2 hours it's still boring, it probably is, and don't do it. But what he's saying is you have to, sometimes a thing can take ages. And also, we know more than audiences about what's funny, and they need us to help them understand what's funny, because they don't know, do they? Otherwise, they'd be at home making themselves laugh. So they have to come. But you're right. You know, self-consciousness is like, you think, well, I wouldn't say that, but maybe you would, you know, maybe. So we can only really work it out on stage. That's why, you know, a month of doing a tryout show in Edinburgh every day at 8 o'clock in the morning is better than sitting at home writing for a month. But unfortunately, you know, economics mean those kind of opportunities are becoming harder and harder, which is why it's important that the Exeter Comedy Festival and the Leicester Comedy Festival are able to provide those opportunities. An opportunity to develop new material for new acts being something I notice is conspicuously absent from the Saudi Arabian Comedy Festival, which I notice is in September.
Not the grassroots vibe I thought it would be over there.
describes itself as the world's biggest comedy festival. It has 50 acts. The Exeter Comedy Festival had 54. So the Exeter Comedy Festival is bigger than... you know, you say I'm in the hierarchy of comedy. No, I can get a single offer from the Saudi Arabian Comedy Festival.
Well, I feel really lucky to be in Wales, where we have Macintyth Comedy Festival, and we have Aberystwyth as well, where you have those, and the audiences that have found it are people who are like, we're here for the process.
Yeah, yeah.
We want to see it be rubbish.
Oh, they love it.
And we'll come back and see it when it's good.
And also,
you mentioned a few times having, you know, you're here at Green Man. One of the reasons why you're doing festivals is so your kids can come along. And I was thinking, your audience, which you so brilliantly describe and have this great dialogue with on stage, must be at the stage where they're bringing their teenage kids.
Oh, yeah. In fact, you get three generations now, which
is
brilliant. Yeah. Or you get people coming, we always used to come with our dad and he's died. Oh. And now we come and see you every year to remember him. So actually it's being passed on like a tradition.
So
through
nice.
Yeah, but so there's yeah, you get three generations.
You're like a haunted lamp.
Like no, but for the older people, right, people in their 70s and 80s, they think I'm like the pre-alternative comedians that you won't even remember, like Dave Allen or Jasper Carrot, or this kind of that sort of generation of the we didn't have many of them in the British Isles.
Mm.
They're more American, but they think you're like that. They relate to you like that. Then the people my age, I'm like the last of the alternative comedians.
Mm.
which I just about sneak in under the wire for that, because they were the people that I saw, you know. Mm-hmm. And then for the younger people, I think it's this kind of thing that, you know, the younger people don't see the distinction of age that we did. You look at this festival, and a lot of the acts my kids would want to see are people in their 50s, because social access to things via the internet has jumbled up. So yeah. They don't see things as generationally shifted in culture. So they, you know, so I do get, I get a whole spread of families, and I really, really like that. And that, and also all the, every family likes to come up with their 19-year-old and go, look, it's the youngest person in the audience. There are some young people here, and of course there's actually loads, but they, you like to make them feel like they're a special thing. So yeah, it's good.
That feels, must feel lovely. Well, you have done so much, and I, when I watch you, it's not like someone who's winding down or is like, okay, they've got their patter and they're going to do that. Like you say, you're always pushing yourself in different directions.
Well, I hope so.
So what's still on the list?
I'd like to try and do the sort of show that feels like it could have happened in a nightclub in the 50s. I'd like to be able to wear a nice black suit and shiny shoes and a tie and sit on a stool with a glass of whiskey on a side table and see how much you can do with nothing. Mm. Then I'd like to write the sort of show that I could get into, you know, a camper van and not just do Truro Hall for Cornwall, but go back to doing Penzance Arts Centre, Barnstaple Theatre, Village Hall on Dartmoor, and keep it on the road. Write something so flexible and adaptive and responsive to news. I keep it on the road for 2 years, go to New Zealand, go to Ireland, go to Scandinavia, go to all the places I get asked, and like see what that's like for 2 years, to have something that almost doesn't know what it is and roll that around. And then probably after that, go back to doing a big structured piece like this current one, which has a, needs two people on the road with it. And also, like you say, one of the things that was interesting about George Carlin when he was old was he didn't mellow out.
No.
He went a little bit like anti-woke at one point, but by the end he was back to being the sort of radical we would recognise from the 50s and 60s. And it was much funnier, a really old man doing it.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and aren't we lucky that we work in a genre where being old's not, you know, it confers a sort of right to be mad and to be belligerent. And until fairly recently, I wasn't convinced I would necessarily be alive or wanted to be past a certain point. But now I'm kind of really looking forward to it.